So have you ever gotten to the end of your day and thought, this is it? You ever done that? Maybe it's Thursday. You just got home from work. Maybe in kid days, you got kids and got them settled, got them fed, got them in bed, got the bedtime story out of the way, got all the things, and you had no time left over because it was time for you to go to bed and wake up the next morning, go to work, and do the whole thing over again. Have you ever been in that mundane trap of life? Yeah, there's that exists. We think there are times, I'm not saying right now necessarily, some of you are living your best life right now, but sometimes we think this is all that my life is, over and over and forever and ever. It just seems like this is pointless, that this is never going to end. Most of the time, we have a weekend to look forward to. We have a vacation, a holiday like today. And I actually think that's probably why we've created so many holidays in our culture, because in part, it's we want to honor someone or something, but also we might post on Christmas or on we might post on Facebook like, remember the reason for the season at Christmas, right? Like, we might do that, but that's the extent of remembering that we sometimes do. Memorial Day, for example, right? Like, some of you have served our nation, and thank you for that. I know that's not what Memorial Day commemorates, but aside from a social media post or a quick special on TV, the rest of Memorial Day is like hot dogs and grilling out and sleeping in, right? Like, that's what Memorial Day celebrates. And we look forward to those days where we get maybe a day off of work, or we get an opportunity to see people that we don't normally see. Most of our celebrations are about the party, the food, the break, the different kind of day from the rest of our days. And what that tells us is that there's not a lot of hope floating around. There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of what the Bible would call lamenting. Do you know what it means to lament? It's an expression of grief or sorrow. And that's what some of the Psalms are. A lot of them, honestly. They're laments. They're an expression of grief and sorrow. And when we already are struggling for something to hope in, these Psalms can be disappointing to read. However, that's also the beauty of the Psalms, because they teach us how to hope in something different. What's the definition of idiocy? Doing the same thing over and over and over again, hoping for a different result. So no matter how many holidays we create, we could have a holiday every day, but then we would have a different problem, right? Because if you go eat out every single night, it gets kind of boring, right? You run out of place. And expensive. Yeah, then you don't have a budget for anything else. But if you eat out every day, it becomes the norm. And if holidays were to become the normal, then we would have to create a holiday from our holidays. Think about that for a second. Holy smokes. And that's actually kind of the progression of things. We're noticing that I used to get an Easter basket on Easter Sunday. Did any of you get an Easter basket when you woke up as a child on Easter Sunday? What did it have in it?
Candy.
Recently, what's that? Jewelry. Well, you're lucky. Holy smokes. Right? We colored eggs and we got a chocolate bunny, right? And a few other things. And that was wonderful. More recently, we're seeing that parents are turning Easter into another form of Christmas, right? Girl, you're always heckling me. Holy smokes. You got bikes being given on Easter Sunday now by families. You've got wrapped gifts happening. We're expanding it because we want to make we're looking for something to hope in. Right? And we can decry, well, that was what I got. Well, yeah, that's fine. I don't necessarily think that's how it's going to be in our household. I'm going to buy an Xbox for Elise on Easter, you know. Probably not even Christmas, for crying out loud. But the Xbox is for me. She ain't getting it. Sorry. I don't have time to play video games. But we're searching for hope as a culture. We're putting it in themed months. We're trying to take power away from the government in order to do that. And I'm not that's not a political statement. I'm just saying that's what's happening right now, because we think that we would be better off governing our lives. But there are a lot of things that we're trying to do as a culture, not just in your life. You can disagree or agree with those things, but you're searching for hope too, aren't you? When the days are long, when the body aches, when people aren't doing what you think they should be doing, when they're frustrating your path, you're looking for some hope. So the Psalms teach us how to hope in something different. Not the food, not the party, not the break. They can teach us how to want differently. The Bible tells us to put our hope in the Lord, to cast all of our cares on God, to worry about nothing, to find strength in the Lord. And if you pause for a minute and think about how to do that, there's not really an action plan in the Bible of how to trust in the Lord with all of your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Like, how do you do that? Because if you understand things to work one way, what do? You do it that way. Like, enlighten me on how I change my understanding. What can I do differently to see things? There's not an action plan to change our wants, because we want what we want. Isn't that true? Like, if you didn't want it, then you wouldn't be a want. That's a rabbit hole I went down this week. All right, like I didn't know how to explain it, so I'm just going to leave it alone. But if you take some time to think about that, it hurts your brain. It boils down to perspective and what we honestly believe. It boils down to a battle between the Spirit of God that lives in us and the flesh that we live in. St. Dominic was a Catholic priest who lived in the late 12th century, and he said this. He said, "A man who governs his passions is master of his world. We must either command them or be enslaved by them. It is better to be a hammer than an anvil." In other words, we can make this in a little more catchy statement. Govern your passions or they will govern you. Passion isn't just intimacy and pleasure. Passion is also anger. Passion is disgust. Passion is a motivating feeling. Anything that kind of makes you get up out of your seat and walk towards something can typically be a passion. Govern your passions or they will govern you. And the Psalms teach us the attitudes and the outlook we can have that will help us govern our passions and be holy unto the Lord. Psalm 4 is a great example of this. David wrote this lamenting poem for a choir director to lead people through grief and sorrow, to help them, to help us govern our passions. And it's been titled an evening prayer. Or a night prayer, which is appropriate because the evening is often when we do a little bit of reflecting on the day that we just lived and the day that we're going to be living tomorrow. We typically, if you can't sleep at night, that usually sets you up for a real bad day tomorrow, right? Yeah, that definitely is true. So when you lay your head down on your pillow and everything is quiet, that's when the thoughts that you've kept at bay all day by keeping busy or doing other things, that's when they start rolling through your mind, isn't it? Because everything's quiet, and now all of a sudden they can come flooding in and it can keep you awake at night. So we're going to look at Psalm 4, and we're going to look at it in three different parts. David writes this psalm, and he opens by talking with God, and then he talks to his adversaries, and then closes out by talking to God once again. So keep that kind of outline in your mind as we go through it. I'll remind you of it. But Psalm 4:1 says this: "Answer me when I call, God, who vindicates me." I'm in trouble, you guys. I'm in big trouble. Let's start again. "Answer me when I call, God, who vindicates me. You freed me from affliction, and be gracious to me and hear my prayer." David starts this psalm out by saying, "Answer me when I call. Answer me when I call." Some find this way of addressing God a bit disrespectful, because we often think of domineering people or out of line authority when they give us a command like that. "Answer me when I call you," right? Sometimes with the advent of cell phones, we've had employers that can reach us at all hours now. And so at midnight, you could get a text from a boss and someone be saying, hey, I need to know where you put such and such a thing, or I need to know why this is the way that it is. And you're like, I am not on the clock right now. So answer me when I call sometimes has a really negative feeling to it. But step back and think about the kind of relationship that there might be for David to feel like that he can start a prayer or a song to God this way. You might say this kind of a thing when you're in need of help or when you're afraid something has happened to someone else. Have you ever told a spouse or a child, you answer me when I call you because you scared me? Where does that fear come from? Love. That fear comes from the closeness of relationship, a desire to protect and preserve, a desire to know your whereabouts, a desire to step in when needed, if needed, so that I can know what's going on. Can that be misused and manipulated? Absolutely. Is that more common in today's world? Probably. However, there is this vein, especially when you're trying to be close to somebody and take care of them, that they need to have a responsibility to answer when we call. So in the right context, this represents a close relationship. It represents that you believe you hold a unique place in someone else's mind. David certainly believes this and holds to a unique place. He does hold a unique place in the Lord's mind. We know that from reading other parts of Scripture. But even in this verse, or even in a couple of verses back in Psalm 3, David remembers that God vindicates him, that God frees him and has given him been gracious to him in the past. So he expects him to be in the present moment. David trusts in the Lord. And that's a key component to his seemingly demanding call. Writing about trust, Dr. Henry Cloud has this to say. He says, trust is the confidence that someone will guard what is important to you, what you need, possess, or desire, whatever your interests are. Someone you trust will safeguard the interests you entrust to them. David has entrusted his very life with the Lord. And he has confidence that God will guard his life and whatever purposes God has for him as king of Israel. And as a king over God's appointed, God's people, appointed by God himself, David has a concern for the people that are against him. He does not just want them obliterated. He wants them to come to repentance. He describes how they're against him in verse 2, and it's as if he's talking to them. So we're moving into that next part of this psalm. Psalm 4:2 says, how long, exalted ones, will my honor be insulted? How long will you love what is worthless and pursue a lie? David was initially appointed as king over Israel by the prophet Samuel. A prophet in the Bible serves as God's voice to a certain people at a certain time. David was literally chosen by God to lead the people of Israel. It wasn't by a vote, and it wasn't by stealing power. David was chosen. He was chosen. There's a certain honor that ought to come with that, don't you think? Yeah. If God chose you to be a king over the nation, you could walk around and be like, God picked me. He didn't pick you. He picked me. He didn't pick you. You could hold that over people's head, couldn't you? It's kind of like today when people say, well, God told me. That all of a sudden you're like, I don't know what to say to that. Like, I don't know if God actually spoke to you because he didn't tell me he talked to you, right? So I guess we got to check the Bible to see if what he told you actually lines up with what you're saying he said. But there is a certain honor. There is a certain respect to that position. In Psalm 3 last week, we saw David say that the Lord was his glory. While not exactly the same thing, glory is a synonym for honor. His honor is reflective of the Lord's honor. Not because he thinks he believes he ought to be treated well, but because deep down he has a desire to serve God's people and God himself well. to lead them to be everything the Lord has intended them to be under the guidance of God. That's not me, I promise. It's my battery dying. I'm going to need to replace that before we go into music here in a minute. Today's full of interruptions. Welcome to church. All right. Not going to work. So insulting David, if David's honor is linked to God's honor, if David's glory is linked to God's glory, then insulting David would represent an insult of God. That's backed up by the second line. How long will you love what is worthless and pursue a lie? So David is essentially asking his adversaries, how long will you turn God's glory into shame? How long will you worship idols and love empty things? And that kind of question is beneficial in two ways. First thing is how many times have you asked the question, how long? You sit in your chair at night with no distractions and you think, how long is this going to go on? You lay your head down on your pillow thinking, how long will I have to deal with this? How long am I going to feel troubled? How long before there's peace again? We are God's creation. Let me say that again. We are God's creation. Again, David writes in the Psalms that we are beautifully and wonderfully made, that we are knit together by God in our mother's womb. We have been chosen by God to be here on this earth, to represent His glory to the world. And oftentimes, we find ourselves in places where our honor is insulted by people who love what is worthless and pursue empty things or lies. It teaches us then to direct our frustration to the Lord, but not at the Lord. There's a difference, right? I can talk with my wife about things I am frustrated about. I have to be careful sometimes not to take my frustration out on her, though, right? There is a big difference. We can be frustrated to God, but there are times that we take our frustration out on God. So then it teaches us to cry out for help from God, but not in a way that destroys the other representation of His glory. The other human beings that are causing our problems. Because they too are knit together in their mother's womb by God, regardless of whether they revere Him as God or not. They, just like you, were created by God. They have a chosen place in this world. They're beautifully and wonderfully made. I want you to think about someone that's hurt you, who you hold a grudge against, and I want you to challenge in your mind what you think about them with the words of David from Psalm 139. You are beautifully and wonderfully made. You are knit together by God in your mother's womb. That hurts, doesn't it? But that can change what you want. That can change what you want. To apply God's truth to the things that you're thinking in your mind, even though they may deserve all of the things that are coming at them, and you may secretly hope those things, what we must do is challenge that with God's truth. So we may even confront them out of pain instead of anger to ask them specifically. We might ask someone, how long are you going to go down this path? How long are you going to insult me and destroy my reputation? How long are you going to keep doing this? When are you going to be satisfied? It teaches us to lament the way the world is and turn our hopes toward the Lord and our future in His kingdom, in His recreated world. Secondly, it teaches us what to hate in ourselves, because we ourselves are susceptible to insulting God's honor in other people. We can and often do love what is worthless and pursue lies with our time, habits, wallets, and our trust. We fit that exalted ones title that David uses here because, like Israel, as God's chosen people, we too are chosen by God, especially today, in the grace of Jesus Christ. So the question is not only directed at our adversaries, it's directed at us too. And David has encouragements for us regarding what it looks like to lay down the insults, to lay down the worthless gods, to lay down the lies, to lay down the pain and the agony that comes from maybe attacks in our lives. And first thing he says is in verse 3, he says, "Know that the Lord has set apart the faithful for himself. The Lord will hear when I call to him." He says, "No," or "to be sure." Sometimes we talk about, with a verse out of Revelation, we sometimes talk about sitting on the proverbial spiritual fence, where we got one foot in heaven and one foot in hell, so to speak. We got one foot being a believer, one foot not being a believer. And we kind of waver depending on what serves our purposes the best in that moment. He says, no, pick a side. Decide whether or not you're going to believe, because he's worth believing in. No, be sure, be confident in this, that the Lord has set apart the faithful for himself. He is what it feels like in times of trouble, whether it be adversaries or crummy circumstances. It feels like the Lord has left the building sometimes, doesn't it? It feels like he has forgotten about you. It feels like you're left to fend for yourself, and that is what you are tempted to know, what you can gather by evidence via your five senses. This is what you're tempted to trust in. And if you do, what I want to tell you is that you're going to become self-centered. You're going to become me-focused. You'll focus on you and what you deserve. You'll forget the gospel. You'll forget Jesus. You'll forget your shepherd walking you through this dark valley, whatever it is. And so when we are troubled and asking how long, we must remind ourselves what we know to be true, that the faithful have been set apart for God himself. He keeps them. He protects them like a shield. He orders their paths. And he is listening. He will answer your call. He will not let this thing or those people or even yourself overtake you. David says then in verse 4, he says, "Be angry and do not sin. Reflect in your heart while on your bed and be silent." Often pain, grief, sorrow, whatever, suffering makes us angry. It makes us tremble, because it should not be this way, right? It shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be that I have no time for myself and I've got to repeat the same schedule at least 5 days out of the week, if not more. Deep down in our guts, we know it isn't supposed to be like this. And no matter what laws are passed or who's leading our circles, no matter what disciplines we put into place or what habits we break, we're still going to experience the effects of this disordered world. So here's why you should know. Be sure, be confident, stand firm. God understands your anger. Because whatever it is that you're angry at, he might actually be angry at too. You probably have a genuine reason to be angry. But David says, "Be angry and do not sin." While you have a reason to be angry, you do not have a reason to sin. Let me say that again. You may have a reason to be angry. You do not have a reason to sin. That would be an example of faithlessness, not faithfulness. Choosing faithlessness in the midst of trouble would begin you down a path negating the beauty of the truth and the reminder in verse 3 that the faithful are set apart and kept by God, that He hears us. When is it a challenge to be faithful? We just sang about it. It's easy to sing when there's nothing to bring me down. But what will I say when I'm held to the flame like I am right now? Faithfulness generally comes out not in how much you can serve and what you're committed to and what you can give. Faithfulness often comes out when the relationship is challenged, when the health is challenged, when there is a prayer request that needs to go out. It's not determined about necessarily your disciplines and your habits. It's more determined on how are you going to react. What do you truly believe when you are in pain, when you are angry, when you are struggling, when it seems like none of this is worth it? How are you going to respond? David himself stepped out into faithlessness at times in his life, and that was a contributing factor to him having adversaries in this world. It was a contributing factor to writing some of these Psalms. It didn't mean that God shut him out of heaven once he messed up and was faithless in a moment or in an hour or in a few days. But it did mean that God allowed the consequences of his sin to have an effect on his life. We cannot fault God for this when he chooses to allow the consequences of our sin to affect us. We allow others to feel the weight of their choices too, and oftentimes we judge it to be a good and a right thing. There's a saying I've heard is, you made your bed, now you're going to lie in it, right? Why do we do that? Why do we not just have unlimited grace and generosity for people in situations where they have done something that we judge to be wrong? Because they didn't listen to wise counsel. And so the only thing that they will listen to now is the pain of their consequences. Am I speaking the truth this morning? Because we've all been there, haven't we? We didn't listen to wise counsel in our lives, and we were allowed to experience the weight of our consequences. And it taught us some things. It teaches us to do what not to do next time. It teaches us the value of living the way that God has asked us to live. And David goes on to say, reflect in your heart while on your bed and be silent. In other words, when your adversaries are against you, get alone. When something is challenging you, making you angry, making you sad, making you full of sorrow, get alone. Don't rally a group of people around you to affirm you and to hype you up, to mount some kind of an offensive attack. Get alone in private and be silent. Listen for the Lord in your own spirit. It's very, very clear here. Reflect in your heart while on your bed and be silent. You may share a bed with one other person, but is there anybody else sleeping in that bed usually? No. That means in your quarters, in your bedroom, in your space. Reflect in your heart, in private, and shh. Because he would write in Psalm 46:10, he would say, be still and what? Know that I am God. Another repeat of maybe what this psalm is teaching us. Listen for the Lord in your own spirit. Then David writes in another psalm, 139, 23 and 24. He says, search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my concerns. See if there's any offensive way in me. Lead me in the everlasting way. Oftentimes when we're upset with the world around us, we overlook what we ought to be upset about on the inside of us. We focus on the speck in everyone else's eye while we've got a tree hanging out of ours, right? So the questions that we could ask in this time of reflection is, am I wrong? I'm so angry with this person, or I'm angry with this situation. Am I wrong about this situation? And you may not be. That's fine, but ask the question anyways. Have I been wrong at any point in this? Am I being unreasonable? How many of you have been unreasonable at some point in your life? Okay, half of you are liars. Raise your dang hand, for crying out loud. You've all been unreasonable at some point. Yeah. So, you know, you got it. We've all been unreasonable at some point in time. And the best thing that we can do is not continue to be unreasonable, because our pride won't let us back down and admit that maybe we were being unreasonable. The best thing that we can do is just search our heart nightly when we go to lay our head on our pillow. Have I been unreasonable at some point in this painful, sad, sorrowful, grief-stricken situation? What is God trying to redeem or create in me? Oftentimes the challenges we go through are meant to teach us something. They are a consequence of some kind of sin in our lives that we are blind to. These are great questions to start with. There's many more you can ask, but if it involves a person, consider whether or not you're extending an adequate amount of grace to them in their situation. Do you even know their situation? Do you assume that their existence is just to frustrate you? Because we do that a lot, don't we? Yeah. It's almost never the case, though. Ultimately, what David is encouraging is to run from sin, especially when you're worked up. Letting time with God clear our heads and calm the restless waves in our hearts, not just for our own comfort and so that we can sleep, but so that we can continue to be a representation of His faithfulness. Notice that up until now, though, it's all been mind and soul work, right? It's all been really internal work that we've been talking about. To remember, to be still, to pour yourself out to the Lord in private. But now, let's look at something that we can do. In verse 5, he says, offer sacrifices in righteousness and trust in the Lord. Excuse me. Right sacrifices come from a right heart. Wrong sacrifices come from a wrong heart, in other words. Right sacrifices come from a right heart. Sometimes we do what we want, what we do for the Lord because it's a rhythm or a ritual. On Sunday morning, where am I going to find you most Sundays? That's a ritual. Not a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a ritual, right? My life is planned around a Sunday morning thing. There is nothing. The funeral home could call me and say, hey, we got a funeral at 11 a.m. on Sunday. And I say, well, go fly a kite. You know, like, I can't do that. My life is planned around that. Saturdays, I have to take into special consideration what I do. Right now, even mowing my lawn is difficult on Saturday because of all the dust and the pollen in the air. And you come in and you're like, I can't talk today, right? Because it's ridiculous. But I alter my Saturday plans so that I don't decimate my energy or my body in some way that I can't stand up here and preach. You may do the same thing for some other stuff, right? Like when you go on vacation, you might go outside and get a little extra tan because you know you're going to be outside a little more and you don't want to burn. You might save a little bit of money, not go out to eat so much or not buy so many goodies because you want to be able to go out to eat while you're on vacation. You adjust your life in accordance with how you are going to live your life or what is important to you or what is necessary to keep faithfulness alive. Sometimes it's just a ritual too. Sometimes it would just feel funny to not be in church on Sunday morning for some of you. It would feel wrong. And so you're almost obligated to be in a church setting on a Sunday morning. So sometimes it's just a rhythm. Other times it's because we're trying to prove ourselves and lay claim to a position or a title to win the Most Like Jesus award. because Christians will try to out-Christian another person because it provides assurance that we'll make it into heaven. Other times we just kind of punch in, punch out like we've worked, like a good job that we've worked, just doing what you have to do in order to collect your payment. But people against David were more likely offering sacrifices, prayers, animals, and their presence in the temple, all while seething at David, God's chosen king, and his allies. They did the sacrifices, but they missed the righteousness part. A different psalm might be clarifying here. So Psalm 51:17 says this, "The sacrifice pleasing to God is a what? A broken spirit. You will not despise a broken and humbled heart, God." Do you know what kind of a sacrifice that looks like? What does that look like to offer a broken spirit unto God? That's apparently the righteous sacrifice. On our knees. That's a good visual. The New Testament would tell us that whatever we do, and in fact in everything that we do, glorify the Lord, honor God. Pumping gas. Sometimes we cry about the price, don't we? That stinks. And what follows that? This dang president, these dang governor, their taxes, all these people are making decisions, I could do it better, you know, all that kind of stuff. We do that, right? Eating, we complain about the food sometimes. There's too much salt in this. It's undercooked, it's overcooked. Now, obviously, we have concerns that we don't want to get sick, but in marriage, we sometimes bemoan the person that we're married to, don't we? Don't answer that. Not today. I'm not trying to start fights in your house today. In serving or in working, we want to be somewhere else. In our hurt, we just want it to go away. But while the anger at whatever injustice we feel is very real, we can always turn it around to trust in the Lord. For instance, at the gas pump. The reason I cry at the gas pump is because, Lord, you have blessed me with a vehicle. And the means to put gasoline in my car. And with the freedom to take that car and go wherever I want with it. Because if we had a shelter-in-place order like we had a few years ago, we couldn't take that car very many places, could we? So what was the point of putting gas in the car at that point? Like, it would be really wonderful to not have that. But the complication is a result of a blessing, right? If we want to exercise the privileges that we have, the blessings that we have, there's oftentimes a cost to it. And oftentimes that cost the Lord is going to provide for, isn't He? Absolutely. And so we take what is a blessing oftentimes and turn it into a curse of God's name because it's oftentimes directed at another person. Right? We just established that everyone has been beautifully and wonderfully made, knitted together in our mother's womb by God Himself, and yet we have the audacity to say, that person is making me mad and you made them and that's ridiculous. They are complicating my life right now. We got this backwards. I heard a guy on the internet, and I don't necessarily agree with his position, but he was, apparently there's a debate about free lunches at school right now. I don't know much about it. I just know that there's some legislation going in so that the schools are going to be able to pay for all the kids' meals. I don't have a position on that. This guy did. He said he thought that was a wonderful idea. But when he went to the meeting, the town hall meeting, to hear about what was going on, and I don't know if it was a voting situation or not, he said it was all the people at church on Sunday morning that came into that meeting and were mad about this policy to provide meals to kids who, he in his mind, really needed it. I stung a little bit. Again, I'm not saying his position is right. I'm not saying we should have a position. Man, don't church people get so angry at certain things because the world isn't living the way that we live? And so then when we go and demonstrate out in public what it's like to live in the kingdom of God, we're actually showing them what it's like to not have grace because we elevate maybe something else. Misguided anger, maybe, but another reason to be angry. First world problems, yeah, all that stuff, all over the place. But I think that the church can be called out for more than just that. I heard someone say that hell, this week, say that hell is the most fair place that ever exists, that will ever exist. You get everything you deserve there. And heaven is the most unfair place you'll ever go because you'll get everything you didn't deserve while you're there. The problem is that we believe we deserve heaven and that we are undeserving of hell. Please think about that for a second. It is the face of God. It is the hand of God. It is the love of God that has rescued us from death and destruction. That is what we deserve. The wages of sin is death. The payment of sin is death. It's destruction. It's eternal fire. It's gnashing, weeping of teeth. The weeping and gnashing of teeth. That'd be weird if your teeth could cry. But that is what we deserve. If you're going to believe in Jesus, you must understand that that is what you deserve. That is what you've earned. That is where you ought to go. That if you want a fair world, if you want to see everything be fair, if that is the guiding principle of your mind, your life, your desires, your wants, then by all means. But that's not heaven. Because for God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son. He didn't have to. He gave His one and only Son that whoever would believe in Him might not perish, but would have the gift of everlasting life. The gift, the undeserving gift of everlasting life. I deserve to go to hell. I deserve to be without God's presence. I deserve to not be on this stage. I don't deserve all that I have in my life because I am a sinner. And it is only because of the grace of God that He has given me what I have. And so a broken spirit then says, "Oh, how I have taken your blessings and used them against you, God." A humbled heart doesn't seek more. It is grateful for what is. And so if we can get in the mindset of recognizing that, man, I am actually really blessed. Like, I have so much in this life. And I know that's really hard to see it sometimes. But I have so much in this life. And yeah, I do want more. And that's a problem with me, God. But you have given me so much, and I have not been grateful for that. I have sinned against you so much, and yet you have chosen to forgive me over and over and over and welcome me back into your arms. Lord, you have done so much for me, and I have not given you credit for that. A broken spirit and a humbled heart that is grateful for what He has done. And then David switches who he's talking about, or who he's talking to, and goes back to the Lord saying this, verses 6 through 8. "Many are asking, who can show us anything good? Let the light of your face shine on us, Lord. You have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and new wine abound. I will both lie down and sleep in peace, for you alone, Lord, have you make me live in safety." The question is, who can show us anything good? That's a question that everyone seems to be searching for right now, too. There's war, there's protests, there's anger in the streets, at the dinner table, at the town hall. Even us in this room, we want a glimpse of something good. And David quotes from the beginning, he quotes from the book of Numbers, saying, "Let the light of your face shine on us, Lord." Not the light of a king or a president, not the light of another person, not the light of a child, not the light of a feast or a vacation, or even the light of the summer sun, as beautiful as it is to finally have sunshine, right? He says, we want the light of your face. We want the light of your face. Because you have provided access to far more joy than the safety of a food supply or the comfort of nice, luxurious things. You've provided even those things, and we forget it. And when they run out, we attack God. When we don't have security or comfort, we accuse you, God, of not caring, forgetting all of the ways that you have provided, that you have delivered, that you have protected. Let us be thankful and broken at how much the Lord has done for us, and trust that your deliverance that we experienced before will come again. We trust in the Lord to be the source of our comfort and our joy. Until then, though, much like Israel wandered through the wilderness on their way to the promised land, I know, I will remember that you, God, have set me apart for yourself. I will tremble in anger. I will be mad at the injustices that are happening in the world and in my life and even within my own body. But I will not sin. And I will offer myself, my actions, my words, and even my thoughts as a living sacrifice that is holy and pleasing to you, because living my life unto you is an act of worship. We believe, what David is teaching us is to believe that God will deliver. But in the meantime, we need to choose him. We must be faithful too. Deliverance will not fix what obedience is meant to kill. Let me say that again. Deliverance will not fix what obedience is meant to kill. We have been called to crucify our flesh every single day. So what do we do with all of this? Some of us came in here heavy, worn out, frustrated, confused, feeling like we're on an endless treadmill of work, worry, and waiting. And like David, maybe you've laid in bed lately asking, how long is this going to last? Maybe you've cried out, God, answer me, answer us, just answer. Psalm 4 reminds us that God does hear. God has set you apart, and God is your peace. But to experience that peace, you must respond in faith and obedience. So let me ask you, are you angry? If you are, you probably have a good reason. But have you given it to the Lord? Or has it taken control of your words, your thoughts, and your attitude? Are you offering your life as a right sacrifice, or are you just going through the motions? Are you looking for joy in a new season, in a new job, in a new relationship? Or are you resting in the joy that only God can give? Are you choosing faithfulness today, or just waiting for deliverance to fix what obedience was meant to kill? You can lie down and sleep in peace tonight, but not because the world is fixed. Because God is your safety. God is your hope. God is your shield. God is your vindicator. So here's the invitation. Reflect first. Where is your heart misaligned? And then repent. Where have you let your emotions govern you? Where have you let your passions govern you? And finally, recommit to live every moment, even the mundane moments, even the painful moments, as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to our Lord. Let's learn to lament with hope, to be honest with God, but also to be still before Him, to govern our passions because our hearts are governed by Christ.